And now we will talk about taking telephone calls from the dead. Cal Cooper joins us, and we'll be back with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Cal Cooper, experience in psychology and psychological research methods, currently based at the University of Northampton, out there in the United Kingdom, pursuing doctoral research in psychology and parapsychology. Also a frequent co-host on the radio show Ghost Chronicles, and has published articles and papers about hauntings and psychic ability, and his book, Telephone Calls from the Dead, Cal Cooper. Cal, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks, George. How are you?
Good. Looking forward to this. So what time is it? I mean, you're a neck of the woods.
At the moment, it's 10 past 8 in the morning.
Ah, well, that's not bad. It's right now, it's midnight on the west coast of the United States as we do this. Hey, tell me your interest in the paranormal. How'd that start for you?
That started a long while ago. When I was at school, we used to have trips once a week to the local library. So we'd all leave school and go into town and go to the library. And there was one particular area of the library that had about a dozen or so books on the paranormal that were written to a level for kids, really. So that they included all kinds of famous accounts of the paranormal. And me and my friends used to go and sit there and just go through them and look about UFOs, and we'd look up things on Bigfoot and so forth. The things that caught my attention were things such as Harry Price's research. Harry Price, the famous ghost hunter from the 1930s in the UK. And he investigated the famous case of Bawley Rectory, and also the case of Jeff the Talking Mongoose, which was known as the Haunting of Cashin's Gap, which took place on the Isle of Man. And to this day, those cases still fascinate me. But it was those initial trips to the library and reading this, these accounts that got me interested. I grew up in Nottinghamshire in the UK, and I've still got family there. And when I visit there, it's full of old haunted locations. It's home to some of the oldest pubs in the UK. It's got some fantastic abbeys and castles that you can go and visit there, all with their own unique hauntings. So when I was small, we used to frequently visit these for picnics and so forth. So I'd always ask my grandma about the hauntings that had happened at Newstead Abbey, about the White Lady and the Black Friar and Lord Byron's dog that haunts the grounds. So it stuck with me ever since I was a kid.
And out there in Nottingham, I wonder if the ghost of Robin Hood is ever out there, huh?
Oh, absolutely. there's a massive statue of Robin Hood outside Nottingham Castle. I don't think there's any particular hauntings related to Robin Hood himself, but certainly the castle has got some fantastic stories related to it, particularly one room, if I can remember rightly, that had poltergeist activity where the paintings used to drop off the wall and people would go in there and they'd suddenly feel it. The temperature dropped to a really cold rate and everyone would have to leave the room feeling unwell. So certainly, you know, there's loads of history of haunting surrounding the whole legend of Robin Hood and the castle there.
What have you concluded, Cal, about what this might be, this paranormal world beyond our own? What do you think it is?
Well, I've never reached any personal conclusions from it. I mean, growing up and reading these stories, I was always fascinated, thinking, wow, well, there must be something to it because so many people are reporting these things. You know, not everyone could be hallucinating these things. People are seeing objects move. People are seeing apparitions walking up and down a corridor in a certain location. People are having these premonitions of great disasters before they happen that are so specific. And becoming a psychologist, I've had to really step back and not really take any particular viewpoint on it. I don't particularly believe in ghosts, though I don't doubt that people experience them. I think if I did take a personal standpoint and say, yep, there's definitely life after death, I definitely believe in ghosts, then it kind of biases any research that I do. So I haven't reached any definite conclusions, but I'm certainly not going to push any of these accounts to one side or the possibility that we do have psychic abilities.
What drives you, Cal? What pushes you in this field?
Well, a number of things, really. I suppose growing up, again, I never thought I was going to end up studying parapsychology. After I did all the reading of paranormal phenomena at school, I went on to college, and I ended up studying a variety of things. I did electronics, photography, psychology, general studies, and I mainly did acting. I made some short horror films for college, and they got shown at various cinemas in Nottingham. And I really wanted to do acting and kind of get into that. But then I thought, no, too many people are wanting to become actors nowadays. I don't stand a chance. Just go into something practical, something that's going to be useful in later life that, you know, loads of people are calling for. I won't have to get picked out of the crowd to do acting. Do something like psychology, because it can be applied to so many things, so many businesses and counselling and so forth. So I studied psychology. I really concentrated on that at college. And then when it came to university, I had to look up and down the country at the various psychology degrees on offer, what modules were being taught at various universities. And I realized that there were several really good ones that were studying parapsychology and teaching it with some really well-known parapsychologists at those universities. So I thought, well, I can focus on various aspects of psychology, but I can still keep this original passion and hobby of the paranormal alive by studying parapsychology. So it's that's what drives me, I suppose. My hobby has become my job at the same time.
That's right. And would you call yourself a researcher, Cal?
Yes, absolutely. That's what we're kind of all trained up to do in psychology. It's forced from day one that psychology isn't all about just talking about the brain. It involves a lot of data collection. It involves a lot of statistics, playing around with data analysis packages that some people find very complicated to use and puts a lot of students off. But certainly, I mean, a lot of the things that I've had to do even for parapsychology has involved understanding different research techniques. How do we go about investigating a haunted location? How do we go about testing for psychic abilities? They all involve various methods of the social sciences that we need to apply to make sure that there's no trickery going on. There's no way that the experimenter can manipulate what's going on to make it seem as though paranormal abilities are present. We want to make sure that we're trying to capture things as natural as possible to actually find out what's going on.
You have written a very interesting dissertation for your psychology degree about being stared at. This is something that has always fascinated me. How did you even get into that?
Oh, absolutely. I know you've had Dr. Rupert Sheldrake on the on the show before, and I've met him a few times when he's come to give guest lectures at the University of Northampton. And when I was in my second year as an undergraduate, I had the opportunity to do an independent project. And my supervisor, who's now become my PhD supervisor, Dr. Chris Rowe, he suggested that I did something on the sense of being stared at, because we could test it in the lab, and we had all the facilities for it. But I started to shy away from laboratory research, because I thought, well, there's so many people now trying to test for psychic abilities in the lab, because this is what maybe the cynics are after. They're saying, well, there's no such thing as psychic phenomena. We'll only believe it when you have evidence for it in the lab under controlled situations. Now, Rupert Sheldrake's done loads of research in the lab on the sense of being stared at, with some fascinating results and incredible statistics come forth showing brilliant significance and possible evidence suggesting that these abilities are present, that we could detect the stare of someone when they're staring intently at the back of our head. But I wanted to look at this in the real-world setting. I mean, I wanted to forget what the cynics and the really hardcore skeptics are saying. I class myself as an open-minded skeptic, but I at least wanted to see how is this occurring as a natural process. So forget the lab. I wanted to go and film overtly. I couldn't disguise myself with a camera, but I had to take out a small camera. I went out into the public. I went to shopping centers. I went out into town centers. I sat on park benches, and I watched people. I picked the right people out of the crowd, I'd film them and give them at least a perfect amount of time where I could stare at them, and then a period where I wasn't staring at them. And I'd have to make sure that I'd film them for a decent amount of time, at least 20 seconds for each trial, where they were facing away and they didn't actually walk away in the middle of the experiment. It took ages and ages to gather all this data. I think it was about 100 participants in total. None of them knew they were taking part in the study. I never went up to them afterwards to tell them that they'd taken part in a study, because it was so brief and the whole object was just staring and seeing if they reacted physically. And then the footage went off to an independent judge to actually judge what was possibly the staring and the no staring condition, to see if we could find significance for when I was staring that they actually reacted. So after the second year project, that was really significant. I did it in the summertime, and we got some really, really good results. And so I thought, well, I can take this on now. I can learn from this pilot study, and I can do a full dissertation in it. And but unfortunately, you can only do dissertations at certain times of the year. And when I had to do a second data collection, it was snowing. So the results weren't that great, but there were still some interesting findings that we got from, again, people's reactions. When I stared at people, there's the odd few people where I thought, wow, that's great, because they'd be, you know, maybe 50, 100 yards away or so. I'd be looking at them, they'd be doing some job in town, picking up some boxes, and all of a sudden they'd stop what they were doing. They'd look up, and then they'd look left, they'd look right, and then they'd turn completely round, and then they'd scan the crowd, and all of a sudden their eyes would fix on me, and then I'd have to look away and pretend I was reading the newspaper or something like that. I mean, maybe it was just chance that they were turning around, but it was incredible the fact that I picked them out of the crowd to stare at the back of their head. So maybe there was some sort of unconscious psychological psychic processes going on there.
Cal, when I was in high school, I would do those kinds of experiments. I would stare at someone, I was behind them, and I would just wait until they turned around, and I would do experiments with it sometimes. I would check it. It's an amazing thing.
Yeah. So did you actually start to write down some of these studies that you did?
No, I never did. I was just winging it, you know, just to see what would happen. And in some cases, it worked. In male or female, they both generally turned around after a certain time. I don't know if that was probability or what, but it was strange.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Probability is the main thing that we have to look for, because it is basically, to some extent, a 50-50 chance that someone's going to turn around, especially in the laboratory, because they're told, just raise your hand or press the bell every time you feel the sense of someone staring at you. But there will be staring trials and there'll be no staring trials, but you're not going to know which is which. You'll just hear a buzzer and then you'll know it's the start of the trial. And this is something that Rupert Sheldrake obviously had to take into consideration. And he started off doing some of these studies at home as well and showed that, you know, these are easy studies that anyone can try out for themselves. I mean, next time anyone goes to the shop, just try it. If you see someone busy doing something, they're some distance away from you, facing away, just stare at the back of their head and just think, you know, just try and force this stare to the back of their head and try and get them to kind of turn around and recognize that stare. Loads of people have done studies since Sheldrake's study and his book as well. And they've gone to libraries and all sorts and had to take in this coincidence factor into account.
Sure. Tell me about...
It's been going since the late 1800s as well, and some people originally thought it was the work of science fiction and delusion, but there certainly seems to be something going on when you look at the present-day research.
It goes way back, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Tell me about some of your work into this phenomenon of telephone calls from the dead.
Again, that goes back to my undergraduate studies. When I was... I think I was in my second year, I was going through the library and I was in the parapsychology section and I was looking at various authors that were there and certain topics, and I've always been interested, because of my roots, I've always been interested in hauntings and apparitions, and I picked up a book called Survival and Apparitions, or something like that, Survival of Death and Apparitions by Raymond Bayliss. And I started reading that in the halls of residence, and he was giving all these cases that were suggestive of survival of death through people's experiences with apparitions and interacting with them. And I thought, well, this is really great. It's a nice book. It's well written, and he sourced a lot of the early material from the Society for Psychical Research. And noticed that he kept on mentioning D. Scott Rogo as well. And so I found some of Rogo's books and went through those, and I thought, you know, these are really good, so I started to look for more. And then eventually I came across a book that they both written together called Phone Calls from the Dead, which was written in 1979. And I didn't really kind of think much to it at first. I didn't read it. I just had a look as it turned up in the post and just put it on the pile of books that I had to read for my psychology degree. And then it was because of a news report that I'd seen on the internet that happened in 2008, of a guy called Charles Peck, who'd died in a train collision in California. And he was supposedly calling his family after the train collision, and it was interpreted as a phone call from the dead. It's possible that it was a phone call from the dead, but this is how the media also advertised it. They said a loved one calling after they passed away and explained the whole circumstances. And it was mainly that his mobile phone was calling his family member's mobile phone, his son, his daughter, his wife, and every time they picked up, they heard static, and every time they tried to call back, it said that the phone was turned off or the battery was dead. You know, it could have been thrown in the collision and calling everyone in the recent call register. Who knows? The point is, I thought, well, wow, you know, people are still reporting these things, or at least the media are still reporting these things. I want to see if people are still reporting phone calls from the dead, because they're not a very kind of well-known phenomenon. Everyone knows about ghosts, hauntings, psychic abilities. What about telephone calls from the dead? So I went and read Rogan Bayliss's book, and I thought, this is great. You know, why has no one ever done anything beyond this? They took 50 cases of phone calls from the dead. They investigated them as far as they could. They went to interview people and additional eyewitnesses in some cases. And from looking at 50 cases and conducting a content analysis, whereby you lay out all the cases you have written down and you start to make notes as notes for patterns of characteristics, so then you can start putting all these accounts into different piles. And this is what they did. They ended up with about four different types of calls in their study. And the first ones were called type one calls, simple calls. This is where you've just lost someone, a friend or family member who's just passed away.
And do you know that they've died at that point?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This is where people are aware that they've just lost a family member. They could be at home grieving, and then the telephone rings. Just a slight ringing is enough to get you to stand up, go and pick up the telephone, and then you hear maybe their voice say your name or goodbye or something like that. And sometimes it's accompanied with static, and then their voice fades out. And then you have a second type of call, which is the prolonged call. This is where you're not aware that anyone's died. The telephone rings, you pick it up. You have a conversation with a friend or family member for about half an hour. Put the phone down. Everything seems normal until, say, a friend turns up at the front door and say, oh, did you know that Joe died yesterday? Yet you just got off the phone from Joe, maybe 10 minutes previous to that. And you're like, well, wow. And then everything hits home and you realize what's just happened. And you think back to that telephone conversation. And you realize in many cases that a lot of the things that they said within that half an hour call or so were suggestive of being very final, such as, I'm going on a long journey, you know, you won't be hearing from me for a while, I hope all is well, take care of yourself. Some really nice things, and maybe even kind of settling arguments that went on as well. And sometimes when you check with the call register and the phone bill, these calls aren't even registered as well. There's multiple eyewitnesses to see you take them.
That's true.
The third type of call is when you go to make a call. You intend to call a friend, you go to call them, they pick up the phone, you have a conversation, and then when you put the phone down, again, you later find out that they were dead at the time that the call took place.
Remarkable.
And the next type of call that they had, which was called intention calls, did not involve the dead at all. These are when you intend to call someone, but at the last minute, you change your mind and think, nah, I'll call them later today. I've got things to do. I've got some paperwork that needs doing. During that time, whoever you intended to call still receives a telephone call from someone with your voice, your personality characteristics, your intended conversation, and they might make a note of the telephone call, or they have the conversation and then forget something and then have to ring you back later. And it's only when they ring you back that you realize the confusion, and they insist that they had a call from you in the morning, when you in fact tell them, well, I was going to call you this morning, but I thought I'd leave it till later in the day. And these are remarkable. Even the author of Telephone Calls from the Dead, Scott Rogo, had an example of this case himself. I'm just going to find it for you.
That is dramatic.
Yeah, it's one of the things that kind of sparked the authors to actually write the book. Just before they wrote it, Scott Rogo had this account. He said, it was 4 o'clock on a bright Thursday afternoon, and I was lying on my living room couch thinking about making a phone call to a psychologist I knew at the UCLA Neuropsychiatric Institute. Although I intended to make the call, I never did. About 6 that evening, though, I got the shock of my life when a call came in from the institute and from the office of the very psychologist I had thought about calling. The call was from her assistant saying that he was answering my message. When I asked what in blazes he was talking about, he told me at 4 p.m. a call had come in to them from me. The caller had left my name and had asked that the call be returned.
Weird. I love that. It is weird. Stay with us. Cal, we're going to come back in just a moment. We'll talk more about your work, Telephone Calls from the Dead, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Why don't you share some of your paranormal experiences with us next hour with Cal Cooper? And when we come right back, we'll talk more about telephone calls from the dead on Coast to Coast AM. Cal, what do you think these spirits from the other side are trying to communicate when these phone calls are done. Maybe they just want us to know that they've departed.
Well, absolutely. If they are indeed some kind of essence or whatever remains of consciousness after we die, and somehow they're affecting the telephone to contact us, in a lot of cases, especially the Type 1 calls, they do appear to be giving a final farewell that that person couldn't actually give in person, maybe because the family member or the friend wasn't around at the time that they died. But also, there are some cases as well where some of these friends or family members had arguments, and the phone call is a chance for them to actually kind of depart on good terms before they actually go. I think there were some rare cases as well that Rogan and Bayless mentioned where even your enemies could call you after they died and still end up tormenting you afterwards. I didn't actually get to read any of these accounts, but they had actually mentioned it. So there seems to be positive calls and very negative calls as well. Like, you have positive near-death experiences of going to this light and feeling at peace, or going to these great, you know, golden pearly gates, or going to hell as well. So there's always this kind of positive and negative effect. You could have a happy haunting where you feel pleasant in the location, or you could have a negative one where it always feels bad and things are being thrown at you.
Oh, that's true, too. That's true, too. What, you know, with some of the travels you have taken, do you hear this in other regions of this planet, similar stories like that, that these entities come through?
I don't know why I'm saying we, it was me. I went through all these cases, and I looked at mainly the samples from the USA and the UK, and the more I started to do research and advertise that I was doing more research on it, I got other cases that came in also from France and Germany, Spain. So there is, to an extent, there was also a big study as well in Italy, a fairly big one in the 1980s, 1984. A guy called Dr. Massimo Biondi, and he read Rogan Bayless's book. He's a medical doctor and parapsychologist over in Italy, and just after he'd read the book, he thought, right, I'll do a study myself. And he went on radio, he went on newspapers, did all kinds of advertising for people to come forward with strange paranormal calls, and got about 40 cases presented to him, and he studied this for about a year. And when he investigated them, he found that about 20 cases or so were credible. And then when he ran a content analysis and compared them to the cases that Rogan Bayless found, he found that the call categories were exactly the same. They virtually matched. So there seems to be, in every culture that has telephone technology, people seem to be reporting this phenomenon somewhere, or at least experiencing it. I'm fairly sure that every culture that's got a telephone, someone somewhere will have had a strange experience with a telephone. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they'll subsequently report it to anyone, because a lot of the people that have reported these experiences have felt very kind of embarrassed to actually discuss it with anyone, obviously fearing ridicule with someone saying, it was a wrong number, or someone was pranking you.
Indeed. Now, you've been to Egypt. Tell me about that trip.
Yeah, I recently I recently came back from Egypt, somewhere that I wanted to go for ages. My master's degree looked at afterlife beliefs and basically where do they come from, and is there a difference in people's personality traits and different creative personalities as to how we perceive the afterlife to be. Do more creative people have this more detailed version of the afterlife compared to less creative people? So I've always been fascinated in the roots of where afterlife beliefs come from, and Egypt is an obvious great place to start. And we went over there, and I also wanted to look at people's beliefs on ghosts over there as well. But I got to go to the pyramids, and it was fantastic. I couldn't help but walk along the walls and the pyramids and just keep touching everything. I was just gliding my hand across hieroglyphics and everything. Just
strange feeling, isn't it?
Oh, it's incredible, knowing how old they are, but then also the fact that there's so much mystery surrounding them. And when I got inside the main pyramid and I went to the main burial chamber, and you realize that there's nothing on the walls, there's no hieroglyphs in there, there's just the tomb, that's it. It's just fascinating that entire structure has been built for one person because of their belief that this person is going on into this afterlife, this higher place. And they spent about 20 to 30 years or so constructing this pyramid, and then go on to do one for his son and then that guy's grandson as well. And that fascinated me so, so much. And because of that, before I went to Egypt, I wrote a paper for the Journal of Para-Anthropology, and it was called The Ka of Ancient Egypt. And I was basically just tinkering with the idea of has Egypt's views on ghosts changed from ancient to modern Egypt? Mm-hmm. And because they have such a religious clash over there as well between Christianity and the Muslims as well. And I've studied both their views on ghosts as well. And when I look at the ancient texts and people's ancient accounts of ghosts, they don't really appear to have changed all that much when we look at modern-day experiences. People, when I spoke to them in modern day, the locals, they were still very much afraid of ghosts and considered them as a deterrent from going to certain places. When you know that a certain area is haunted, people tend to stay away from it. And you could argue that that was why the idea of ghosts came about in ancient Egypt. Maybe it was some form of social deterrent, a way of policing society to stop you tomb raiding. If you go into someone's tomb and try and nick the gold there, you will encounter the ghost and the ghost will attack you or something like that. And some of the ancient accounts were indeed priests going to various locations throughout Egypt on an expedition with some of their servants, and they go looking for a suitable place where they'd want their own tomb to be. And in doing that, they'd stumble across someone else's tomb by accident and encounter their ghost, and it's known as the Ka of the tomb. Huh. And it has its own place within the burial tomb called the Hetka, the House of the Ka. And they either built a door or painted a door onto the wall of the tomb in which this ghost, which protected your body, could actually leave the tomb of its own free will to go and wander about, basically. But they didn't believe that this ghost had anything to do with survival of death. Once you die, the ba, the soul, the heart, it's gone on into the afterlife. It goes on into this path of the afterlife with Anubis, the god of mummification, and he guides you through to judgment. And that's when you either pass or fail judgment. If you fail judgment, Amut, the demon, will eat your heart and you effectively go to hell. Or you go on to Osiris and you live on into the happy lands. So when you die, they believed that instead of the soul remaining on earth, the body and its spiritual components splits off into different sections. So we have this Ka, the Ka being an absolute double of the person that died. It would have your features, your personality characteristics, and then there'd also be the Ku as well. The Ku was this spiritual body that left after you died, and that would basically haunt the surrounding areas of the tomb rather than inside the tomb. And this is what we possibly describe as when we see a white mist or a grey mist in certain locations that some people might nowadays refer to as, you know, the white lady. Sure. Or the grey lady. But they often reported these white or grey mists. And people had great respect for the car. It not only scared them if they did encounter it in the tomb, but it was mainly priests as well, as I mentioned before. But there was also some psychological aspects that come in there as well. The main people in ancient Egypt that were allowed to take psychedelic reactants were priests, warriors, and magicians. Mm-hmm. Or entertainers, really. And the main drugs that they had about the time were opium, Egyptian blue water lily, and cocaine, and all being very powerful psychedelics. So the main thing that priests were taking were opium. So it's arguable to say, well, were these priests that commanded so much power in that society, were they seeing ghosts when they went into these tombs, or was it the effect of the opium? I mean, we can't say for definite that they were always on opium.
Or did the opium enhance their ability to see the other side?
Well, absolutely. A lot of psychedelics don't necessarily cause the experience. You could argue that it's causing the experience, but there's a lot of psychedelics like ayahuasca. One of my colleagues here in the UK, Dr. David Luke, is a parapsychologist but also an expert on this, so he's more the guy to talk to. But from all the lectures that he's done, certainly ayahuasca and the opium, people that have had these experiences and then they have a psychic premonition, it comes out with startlingly accurate information, as though the psychedelic reactant has kind of acted as a key to the brain, and it's unlocked this psychic potential. And because the priests having these experiences and encountering the car, they come out and tell society, I've just experienced the ghost of the tomb, it's unsettled, so I'm going to take back incense twice a year to keep the ghost happy. And also it needs food and water, so you need to bring food offerings to the dead. And this is why when you see a lot of dig sites in Egypt, you get a mass amount of pottery around burial sites because they believe that the dead and more so the ghost of the tomb need this food to survive. Because otherwise, when it leaves the house of the ghost, the hetkar, it will go out and eat whatever it can find, and it needs good food if we need to show respect to the dead. And in other cases of more modern Egypt, we move away from this idea of the certain ghost surrounding death, but we have the idea of genies and also Afri. Afri are ghosts that appear after a violent death. So say someone dies on the road in a motorcycle accident and their blood is spilled on the ground. They believe that the essence of the ghost from that person is that it's the spiritual entity that comes out of the blood, it goes into the ground, and if you disturb that ground later on, you'll encounter the Afri. And Afri, again, is an exact representation of that person to an extent, but upon encountering it and seeing it when it walks towards you, people have reported it growing in size. This ghost actually expands and it can get the size of a house, and they believe that it can bend right over a person and squeeze them to death. And again, you think, well, is this actually something people are reporting as a genuine phenomenon, or is it some sort of social construction to deter people from going to certain places? But when I spoke to people in Egypt and asked them, even though the were reluctant to discuss such experiences, I did actually come across a few people that had encountered an Afri, and when they walked towards it and they saw it growing, they just ran in fear. But their account was quite remarkable. They described it in quite good detail and also gave me times and dates as to when they saw it.
Why do most people run in fear like that rather than just stand there and learn?
Well, I think it's because, particularly with the Afri, the idea has been put into people's heads that it can kill you.
Sure.
It will grow, and it will lean over you, and it will squeeze you to death.
Yeah.
And one of the people
or possess you or something.
Absolutely. That's what the genies are said to do as well. The genies, they can, when they haunt a particular location, they're known to be responsible for possession. A lot of people believe that they can enter a man through the mouth and take control of his body. When this happened in ancient Egypt, people didn't see this necessarily as a bad thing. They thought if someone's become possessed, we can talk to them. We can learn from this higher power, these gods and so forth that have entered this person's body and chosen to possess this person. You know, wow, lucky them. In modern Egypt, there's been various different opinions on whether it's a good or a bad thing. And particularly with genies, I think it's considered more of a bad thing when someone gets possessed. And it is definitely evil demons in kind of their opinion. But you've got a threat from both of the modern ghosts in ancient Egypt. The genies can possess you and the Afri can attack you. The person that was walking towards this lady at 4 a.m. that I spoke to, he was walking down the road, it was 4 a.m., and there was no one else on the road apart from this old lady covered in garments. And the closer he got to her, the more she started to grow. And this isn't just a visual perception thing, where obviously when you get closer to things, they get bigger. He said, you know, she was getting the size of the lamppost, and then she got the size of the building. And he just didn't want to know what was going to happen next. He just ran in fear, possibly because of all the stories growing up as to what the Afri can do. If you get close enough, it will grab you and it will squeeze you to death.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Now, tell me, what has been for you, Cal, the scariest story that you have ever crossed?
There are various ones, really. I'll go back in a second to some of the telephone call accounts. I'll go from some of the early ones to the modern ones to kind of show how it's changed over time. But in my own experience, when I started out in parapsychology, the main thing that I did apart from reading around the subject, was I went out and I did practical field investigations into haunting phenomena. And I spent several years at a place called Plesley Vale Mills in Mansfield in Nottinghamshire. And in the centre of Nottingham, I spent a couple of years at a place called Clifton Hall as well. And in both locations, after spending maybe several months there, we did experiments where we do trigger objects and we take old items, pennies, an old whistle, and we'd set up a video camera, we'd draw around the item, sign and date it, and we'd keep the camera rolling. And I'd always be the last one to set up the experiment. I'd be the last one to leave the room. I'd be the one holding the keys and everything, so I knew that I was the only one who could actually lock and unlock the doors. And I'd always be the first one to return to the room to make sure that no one had tampered with the items. In Clifton Hall, we set up the first night we were there, I was there with two investigators, and I set up a whistle and an old penny, and all the numerous other trigger objects were pennies and various other items, but this one particular one was set up in the old children's nursery on the top floor. Throughout the night, we had various things, such as the main security gates out front. They kept on opening on their own. When you need something at least 4 foot tall on the inside of the hall to cross through the beam barriers to actually activate it, as though a car's going through, so it opens the gates for you. And we kept on looking out the window and seeing this happening around about 3 or 4 a.m. And we were just seeing the gates opening and closing. And when we asked security the next day, they said, well, that happens all the time. And I said, well, do they have a sort of reset time? Is 3 and 4 a.m. the time when they kind of reset themselves, so they have to open at least once and close? And they said, no, they shouldn't do that until something passes through the beam barrier. So that was unusual. Going back to the trigger object, when we returned after spending maybe 2 hours or so taking a break and setting up other experiments, we said, right, it's time to go back to the children's nursery and check on the trigger objects. And we filmed our return to that room, and you can see on the head of the camera, you can see it on YouTube actually as well. When I go up to the trigger object, I don't think anything's moved at first until I shine the torch on it, and you see that the pen is moved just about a centimeter outside of the circle. And that was probably the very first kind of essence of paranormal phenomena that I ever really encountered. After that, when we went to Pleasantville Mills, I was there with two police officers, as well as an investigator, and we were in this room that used to house looms. So if you imagine in the 1800s, all these looms going back and forth, making big sheets of fabric and textiles, and all these little children that are being paid a few pennies every day just to go in and reach for these stray pieces of cotton that are in the machines, and possibly catching their fingers at times and getting injured really badly, and even some of the adults getting badly injured in the machinery. A very noisy place as well, and possibly quite scary to be. And in modern day, that room's empty. There's these massive pillars, ceiling to floor, really big room, at least 100 yards across, and you've got these big glass windows as well that are about 15 foot high, and then they go down to the floor where you've got a 3 foot gap of brickwork beneath. So you can see the entire room. It's empty, and there's these big spotlights coming through at night time, giving you a good clear view of the room, except for the very end where it just slowly gradually gets into darkness. And we got night vision cameras as well, and we can see all the
sure,
exits.
That
there's
helps.
Only one exit to the room. So we picked up these stray pieces of rubble that were on the floor. They're basically rocks that had come loose from the wall or the ceiling, and we just started throwing them across the room and filming them going off into the very end of the room, into the darkness. And we were saying, if there are any children here, would you like to come and play? Would you throw one of the rocks back? We got nothing until I said, you know, right, that's it. We're getting bored now. If there's any children there, I want you to throw this rock back. Now, the building's so old, the center of the floor had actually given way over time. So you've got a big wooden floor, and in the center, they'd put really big metal panels in the floor. So when we threw the rock, you could hear it tap the floorboard, you could hear it ting on the metal, and then tap the last bit of floorboard towards the end of the room. And as I threw this rock saying, you know, this is the last one, you hear it go tap, 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 ting, 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 tap, tap, and just stopped. And I said, right, that's it. And then you hear bang, tap, tap, ting, ting, tap, 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 tap. And it rolled. Another rock came and rolled all the way back to us as we asked for something else to come back. And the video camera just panned to the rock and just slowly folded it, come all the way back and stopped right by our feet. And I just stopped and looked up at my friend, who's a police officer, and I just looked him straight in the face, and we just sort of sighed and went, wow, you know, what'd you say to that?
That's pretty dramatic. Hey, Cal, we're going to take this break. We're going to come right back with some phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM as we talk about telephone calls from the dead.